Good evening. At this time, Mel, K2KEY, and Dick, K2RIW, begin the TechNet. TechNet number 1233 of the series that began way back in 1982, the Dark Ages. Main purpose of the TechNet is education. A little bit of entertainment squeezes in from time to time. A person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this. N2NNU, Alex, and yes. So do we have any check-in tonight? Please give me your call letters and name at this time.
N2EO, Rich, and yes.
Rich recognized. Anyone else?
KC2MDP, Steve, no questions.
Steve recognized with a no. Anyone else? Here, wait, Steve's going to have a question once he finds out when we really get rolling. Anyone else, give me your call letters and name right now if you want to check in.
N2MB, no questions. Good evening.
Hey, Barry, haven't heard from you in a long time. Glad you're back and hope you do have some questions for us. In fact, if not, I'd like to hear a little bit about what you've been doing with the satellites and space work and so on. Anyone else check into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
Good evening, all. K2KEY.
Mel recognized. The moderator. Anyone else? And if we do have a whole lot of extra time left over tonight, just like Mel has in the past given us some lectures on decimals and the Smith chart, I'm going to give you guys a little bit of a talk on directional couplers, something that's quite misunderstood, very handy, not very expensive object that can do some great things when properly used. So maybe we'll go into that subject. One last call. Anyone else to check into the TechNet who's got a question or a comment, give me your name and call letter at this time. Maybe everybody's watching the Academy Awards. We'll soon find out. Rich, N2EO, you're number one on the runway. What would you like to talk about tonight? What's going on in Whitestone? And are you treating jingles well? You got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick, K2RIW, TechNet, Limark, N2EO. Before I continue, Dick, I sent an email to you and to Mel. Did you get it, Dick?
Give me a clue. When did you send it, and what is the subject?
Okay, I sent it around the middle of the week. It was actually a question with a YouTube video. I guess I can't answer the question. Did you get it, Mel?
Yes, I did. I was going to hold it off for the mailbag, but if you'd like to discuss it now, no problem. It's a very interesting discussion and of the past, over.
Yeah, N2EO with Nostalgia Radio. If you saw that video, Mel, in there, there's a microphone with a picture, the call letters of a radio station around 1935, WADX. I looked on the internet to see if there was a WADX today, and there is indeed in New Jersey, but I wonder if that's the same, if anybody knows where some radio station WADX was in 1935. And also, Mel, at the beginning of that video, I believe that's a spinning disc television. Maybe you can give me an idea how that worked. That's before they had image orthicons and they're experimenting with spinning disc TV. I'm wondering what principle that worked on. Go ahead, Mel, N2EO.
I wonder if that was a flying spot scanner. If so, Mel's going to describe it to us.
Okay, that was a bad wheel.
I understand. Mel first, and then we're going to go over to Eric. You got it, Mel.
Okay, yeah, roger. That was a bad wheel. It was basically a wheel that was driven by a two-speed motor at a constant speed. It had a bunch of holes punched in it, exactly 240, they call it lenses at the time, there was 240 holes punched in this disc. I remember it well because there used to be a place in New York City that had a lot of old equipment. He used to restore old anything from the from up to 1950 backwards. And he had old microphones, broadcast microphone televisions and all, and I saw the disc there. It was known as the Nipkon disc, N-I-P-K-I-K-O-N, I believe it's called Nipkon. I believe by the person who invented it, that actually it was, I believe, a physicist that worked at Bell Telephone Labs, right. That was Bell Telephone Labs. Now let me let it drop and I'll say a few words about the disc. Okay. The disc had, they had a lamp, a very bright lamp. Then they had a lens. Then they had an aperture. And it shined through the holes, the 240 holes in the disc, which turned at approximately 24 revolutions per second. And that gave a line scanning, a horizontal line scanning of 5,700, about 50 lines, I believe. That was the horizontal scanning. On the other side of this, there was a photo cell. And and that's basically how the transmitting system worked. Now, on the other side of the receiving system, let me let it drop. On the receiving system, you had the same disc, and you synchronized it, except what it did, it had a neon lamp that was flashing along through the holes in the disc onto this opaque screen. This was the beginning, this was about 1930-31. Later on, they took the same system with the transmitting disc system, but what they did is they added a CRT. And that was one of the first ones they developed, the CRT, about 1934, I believe it was, the CRT started coming. Basically, that was the system. I can say some more, but I'll leave it on as far. Oh, yes, let me say about call letters. Hold on 1 minute. The call letters, let me see. I have a list here. Funny, I remember the list. CBS Channel 2, 1938. Their New York call letters was W2XAB. Dumont was Channel 4 at the time. Believe it or not, Dumont was Channel 4, W2XWV. NBC was W2XBX, and actually was broadcasting on Channel 1, which became later on, of course, deleted. And then in Chicago, they had Zenith, had W9XZV, Channel 1 in Chicago. Philadelphia had W3XAU, and there was one more on the West Coast owned by the entity company called W6XEA. Let me let it drop and I'll say another one word and then I'll turn it over. The first broadcaster that went online with the news, believe it or not, was Lowell Thomas, 1939, nightly broadcast of the news. How do you like that? And then a lady by the name of Lucy Monroe, and she used to sing songs. The receiver was a radio receiver, AM radio receivers. They didn't have FM in those days as their radio. It was, in other words, separate. The radio, you had a separate radio in the house. That was your radio receiver for the audio. Okay, put that back to you, Dick, and I have quite a bit of information on it. Over.
Fantastic. Mel, where did you get that information from? If a person wants to do some more research on that, where should they go?
This was, like I say, in New York City. I think it was on, maybe I'm wrong, 45th Street or so, Lexington, somewhere off Lexington, that this guy had loads of these old televisions and radios and microphones and all, and he used to restore them, sell them. He used to rent them out for movie sets or, you know, whatever. And it was a very interesting place. I don't think it's in existence anymore. Maybe Eric is more familiar with this, Dick, over.
Okay. I bet you've, in your vast television broadcasting experience, have heard about flying spot scanners and things like that. So tell us what you know and how bad they were, Eric. And I think some of these things were even demonstrated during the 1939 or 38 World's Fair. KE2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2LIW, K2EJ. Actually, JL Bed He's an interesting character. I think there's a website called Bird Television. You can read all that. Get the whole history there. In 1939, it was a Nipkow disc. And mirror drum cameras is what they had. They were mechanical, but they also showed all electronic television broadcasting, which I see was delayed until about 1939. At that point, Philo T. Farnsworth had his image dissected camera. The patents were already out there, and Mr. Sarnoff was the driving character behind all of that. You can also see some of this stuff at the Museum of Broadcasting downtown. I don't remember exactly what the address is. And then there also at Kauffman there's another museum that has some stuff. But, I don't know, when I went to Tokyo, the best thing to all gathered up in one place was at the NHK Broadcasting Museum. That was kind of fun. The first real television system, the first real television system that was broadcast in 1935 was 4-5 line. That was an EMI system that was done out of Crystal Palace in London. But the best system was 30 lines. 30 lines. That was it. Mechanical. And that was in 1929, so there. There's lots of stuff out there if you want to go looking for it.
K2RW, K2J. Yes, good old Philo T. Farnsworth was interviewed on What's My Line, Gary Moore television, I guess that was middle 50s. And by the middle 50s, just about every home in the United States had or somebody knew of somebody who had a television set. I, in 1956 or 57, started doing television repair for the people in my hometown, which was Middle Island. I was the only repair person in the town. And I do remember noting that everybody appreciated television, but no one knew who had invented it. And one of the key inventors was Philo T. Farnsworth, and also the people at what became RCA. Philo Farnsworth, I believe, in some year like approximately 1915, in high school, and I think he lived in Utah, he was watching a farmer plow a field and recognized that what the farmer was doing was a Raster scan. And he explained to his, I believe it was chemistry teacher in high school, the fact that if you could do this electronically, do a Raster scan, you'd be able to reproduce a picture pixel by pixel. He didn't use the word pixel by pixel, but we now know element by element, we now know what that all means. So he certainly had an awful lot to do with the invention of television. I believe that because of the delay of World War II and what Armstrong did, I think he never really got very much recognition or very much remuneration for his contribution to television creation. There's a Broadway play on the subject, which I've personally seen a couple of years ago. I'm so darn forgetful, I've forgotten the name of the play. I'm going to turn it over to Eric, who's going to tell us the name of the play, which probably still exists on Broadway, which explains what happened with Farnsworth and Armstrong. KE2EJ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2RW, K2J. I think you don't really mean Armstrong. You mean Vladimir Zorkin, because there was a contention between both of them simultaneously coming up with their versions of the invention, and both of them actually got both of them to work for each other. So, and I can't remember the name of the play. I don't think it's still out there. I could be wrong, but yeah, there was a play written about the things that went on. Armstrong's role in everything was the Super Heterodyne receiver and the sound portion, which was FM. So that came about after the war. I don't remember what the BBC used. I think the BBC had two AM carriers on the 405 line system. But oh well, you can look that up. K2RW, K2J.
K2KY, give you some more info.
Go right ahead, Mel. aboard, I'd like to remember the name of the play. Something like The Great Invention or something along those lines. And it did give you some idea of the fact that Farnsworth was such a darn straight arrow open guy that Sarnoff sent somebody to visit him, to interview him, and he basically gave away everything that he was working on, you know, talked about the whole principle. Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger, when Dworkin went to visit Farnsworth, Dworkin came back with the information to Sarnoff and said he's got something going on there, and he was developing, Dr. Dworkin was, of course, developing this Dworkin tube, and eventually they stole Farnsworth's idea. Basically what happened, World War II came along. This was 1939, World War II came along, and everything, you know, more or less came to a dead standstill. But here, New York, I was just looking, the New York Channel 2 was the most powerful channel in 1939 on broadcasting television, with 10 kW visual and 3 kW oral signals. The receiver at the time was 5,760 lines, 24 frames per section, developing a picture that was approximately 8 by 8.5. That was the biggest. That was being offered by Dumont. That was the Dumont tube. The most of them, like Pilot here, was producing a 3-inch picture, which I have to have that set. The 3-inch 1939 one, made for the world to see. It was a 3-inch picture, and there was the, let's see, what else? The first long-range broadcast was between New York and Philadelphia. That was using 10 repeaters, Dick, over.
Repeat the number of lines, Mel. Yeah, that number sounds awful big.
I'm looking here, scanning at 5,760 lines or 24 frames per second picture. That's what is here. This is the 1939 specification for the New York World Fair on an 8 by 8.5 inch Dumont tube. Over.
Oh boy, is that a bad misprint.
Yes, you think it's not 5,000, but it really meant to be 500? I think in the early days, numbers like 200, 300, and 400 lines were being used. Isn't that true, Mel? I mean, Eric?
Yeah, the first real solid, what we would call high-resolution television was the 405-line system in London. They were doing, one was 120 lines, and I think at the World's Fair it was 240 lines. You know, 5,000 lines, Mel, is like having four high-definition televisions together. It didn't exist in those days, so that's a serious misprint you're reading.
Sounds, what a beginning television had. What was your first exposure to television? I'm going to ask this question to both Eric and Mel and anyone else, and Rich. What was your first exposure? I'll give you a couple of hints as to what was mine. 1947 RCA 630 set. My grandmother in Kings Park bought one. I think it cost $550 in 1947. That was a lot of money. Double conical antenna installed on the top of the farmhouse. Twin lead came into the farmhouse. Channel 2, 4, and 5 existed for sure. 5, I think, was Dumont. 5, 4 had Howdy Doody in the afternoons. 5 had Captain Video eventually downrange. There was a big to-do there where they were going to install a coaxial cable across the United States. And we were going to start getting television from far-off places in the United States with this coaxial cable. It was a real breakthrough that Howdy Doody and Buffalo Bob in the peanut gallery had a sample of this coaxial cable that they were held up. And this is a new technology. They didn't use those words in those days, but this is a new technology. It's going to really expand television. We're going to start seeing television from very far away places. 1948, my family bought a Philco television set, a 10-inch, and started off with a simple twin lead folded dipole, in the second floor of the house that eventually became, that was the temporary antenna that they gave you when they first brought the set into the house, and a couple days later they came and installed a real aerial on the chimney outside, and you had a lot better reception. And I do remember there being a Channel 13, but it was always the weakest channel. It wasn't PBS in those days. And so Eric's going to tell us what it was in the early days. I do remember also, let me drop. Much of television disappeared by about 10 o'clock at night. They rolled up the sidewalk, so to speak. Eventually you had Arthur Garvey on many hours a day, every single day of the week. Milton Berle, I guess, got rolling somewhere around 1948, 1949. 8 o'clock, Tuesday night, Channel 4, Uncle Milty. The whole world stopped in my neighborhood on Yoakum Avenue in Farmingdale, and we would all go in the house at 8 o'clock at night and watch Uncle Milty. And that was live and funny stuff by our standards. So that was my first exposure to television. KE2EJ, how was the beginning for you, Eric, K2RIW, the TechNet?
K2RIW, K2J. Now, I guess my first real exposure to television was when I was four. My sister wanted to watch something else, and I wanted to watch Howdy Doody. So I took a pair of scissors and cut the line cord. But actually, I kind of got active in television when I was in ninth grade. I was in, of course, the electronics class in high school. And we had, in our school district, we had the first licensed ITFS station. So when I was 14, I was fixing cameras. It was the funniest thing. But we had something called microband microwave system, which was actually 1.4 gigs. And we distributed to the 22 schools. And the tape deck was an FX660B, which is a 2-inch helical machine. Black and white, didn't have the color board in it. And a bunch of stuff that came out of a church in Albany. That's what the school district had to. They didn't have any money, so they got the donation from the state. And that started the New York State Video Exchange Library. And it eventually became a big system throughout the 60s and the 70s. And then as the new technologies came in, you know, that stuff began to fall apart as three-quarter inch and VHS machines eventually came around, even Betamaxes. But I don't know. I've always been interested in it. I actually got to spend time up at NBC when I was 15 and learn a lot of stuff. So that was cool. And of course, at that point, I was already a ham. I got my ham license when I was 11. So I guess I was fixing CBS Columbia TVs that we had in the house. That was pretty easy in those days. K2RIW, K2J.
Hey, you didn't mention what year this all started. What was the name of the school district you were at? I think you said 1.4 gigahertz microwave link. Was that the predecessor of the multi-point distribution system, MDS? That was, I think, eventually on 2.4 gigs. And it was supposed to link the schools together with these 3 or 4 foot diameter red dishes with a simple feed horn assembly on them. And that whole microwave linking of the schools, I remember a lot of these schools had these microwave dishes on the roof, but I never heard very much use of them. I mean, it was a great sounding idea where I presume somebody somewhere was going to create educational material, and it was going to be microwaved to the various schools. And I guess at the appointed hour, the theory probably was, this is guessing on my part, that a television set would be rolled into a classroom and you would watch a piece of educational programming. And in places like Texas, for quite a few years, NASA Select did do just that, supplied educational NASA space-oriented programming to the local schools. And at a certain time in the afternoon, they would stop the normal teaching and watch NASA Select television that's what I think it was called, NASA Select. So what year, what school district, and did you say 1.4 gigs was that microwave link? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ, I'm sorry, 2.4. It's what you would call MMDS, which is actually ITFS, which is an instructional fixed television service, which as of about 4 years ago ceases to exist as that particular service. But many of the licensees, you didn't realize it or not, the school district I started in was Plainview.
And the Archdiocese of Rockville Center has a very huge network to this day. And it was an organization called SOGTEC up in Albany where up until that time you would get your films. You would rent the, you would, this is actually operated by the New York State Board of Education, and they supplied educational films that would get projected in the rooms. You remember in those days that you had a Navy squad and you had kids who took care of getting the projectors in the room, getting them threaded up. And then as television and tape recording and microwaves came around, it slowly and then rather rapidly replaced all of that. In those days, the concept of getting NASA on that was you got it either you got it off a broadcast station and put it on your ICFS channel. You know, this satellite didn't come along until, 1964, you had Telstar. Or 67, I don't remember what year it was. But it actually became very dense and very well used, but then as the later VHS technologies came around, it was very easy to distribute a videotape to your class, and it didn't have to operate on a particular schedule when you were ready to view it. You would just roll the card in with the VHS machine, the TV set, or the Betamax, the TV set, or if you want to go earlier than that, the 3/4-inch machine and the TV set, and there you had your stuff. So that technology has now disappeared into the ether, and now it's, you know, streaming video and that sort of stuff. K2RW, K2TX.
Yeah, Telstar was 1964. There was a song that came out at that time called Telstar. That very first broadcast... where Telstar became operational, and French television was sent live to the United States, and you saw live on camera Yves Montand, which is not his real name, by the way, a famous French actor. And if you go to the website and find out, you know, the real names of all these people. So I think it was a day or two later that from Maine there was a broadcast from the United States back to France. Or was it England? I think England came through Telstar next. But that was the very beginning. Let's see. I'm going to ask Mel, and then I'm going to ask Barry if he's available, N2EO. What was his first exposure to television? K2KEY, what was your first exposure to television? At what age did you start repairing your own television set in the house and the neighbor's sets and the... And I think you got involved in television repair somewhat like I did.
Dick?
Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I just remembered. Channel 13, before it was PBS, was, I think it was WATF or WITF. No, WATF. Oh, no, ATV, sorry. And it was a commercial station that actually went broke.
ATV, sounds like amateur television. WATV, Whiskey Alpha Tango Victor, you believe that was the call letters? Sounds about right.
I think it was WNTT.
Yeah, I think it was ATV. I'm pretty sure. I can look it up, but it's been a while since I've been asked that question, so I don't remember stuff like that.
Wasn't it WNET for a while? Whiskey November Echo Tango?
No, when it first came on, it was actually a consortium of Sarnoff, Fuji, what's his name? CBS, how can I forget his name? It'll come to me. And they basically said, well, this is a commercial channel. Let's start a non-profit. And actually it was Edward R. Murrow who made the very first transmission on WNBP, Nancy Delta Thomas. And if you remember, it had that little owl. I've got a lot of footage from when the station first went on, if you're ever interested in looking at it. Come on by, I'll show you what it looks like. It was 1967, I believe.
WB2 CUK. CUK recognized. We'll get to you in a minute, Bill. And I do remember seeing the repeat of Edward R. Murrow introducing what became public television and what promise it had for the future and so on. The next person I was going to go to is Mel. Let me go to Mel and then pick up Bill in that order. K2KEY. Mel, what was your first exposure to television and your family set and your repair of television sets and so on? You got it, Mel.
Okay, very good. Well, my first exposure to television, believe it or not, was about 1946. My father had a brother that used to buy anything new that came out. He used to have it. He used to go into hot for things. And I remember he had a TV set, maybe, let's see, let me remember what it looked like. It was the reflection of TV that, in other words, the CRT sat vertical. I'm trying to remember who made that set. Cable thing Research put out a set. The picture tube sat vertical, and you had a mirror up on top of the lid. You moved the lid, you know, to adjust it to your comfortable viewing. That was the first shot. Then 1948. I'll tell you what happened in 48. 1948, my mother, may she rest in peace, took a job, a side job, with a school store that was about a block away. She would answer the telephones. She did that for a year. She put away, I think it was $10 a week. She put away the money so that she saved up to buy a TV set. They came out that time. RCA came out with it. 1948 came out with a 16-inch tube. It was a round tube with a metal, had a metal frame, round metal frame tube, over 16 AP4. Know it very well, but it still got the set, believe it or not. Let me see. Because what had happened was previously, we had a neighbor that had a TV set, and I used to want to go in there, you know, six, seven years old. And every time I went in there, the kid that, he was my age, he was very strict. If he made me sit in a certain chair, if you move a little bit, you have to get out. Why? He just was a boss. So he threw me out all the time. Just if I laughed a little bit at the program or whatever it is, he got annoyed. He's a character. Richie, I run to him every so often. I remind him of it. He laughs. He says, "Oh, he says I was 7 years old. What do you want from me?" Let me remember. Wait one more. Hold on. Okay. Started fixing TV when I was about 13 years old. Started working in a radio store. And, it was just about, just before I got my ham license. I was 13, 1953. And I started working part-time in a radio store, actually fixing radios. And then I went to, entered Brooklyn Tech in about 1954. So I was 14 years old, Vic, so... You know, well, that's, you know, the same age as you, so whenever you started, I started. I was your competition here in Brooklyn. Go ahead.
Hey, you started considerably earlier than me. When it comes to doing repairs, I don't think I really got rolling until around 1956. When you were already well involved in the repair store, I think you said in 1954. Mel and I were born the same month, the same year. And so we compare notes from time to time. Bill, WB2CUK, what would you like to tell us, and what was your first exposure to television? And you're a collector from way back. I bet you you've collected some interesting ancient TV sets. WB2CUK, K2LIW.
Yeah, K2LIW. Before I start, how does this radio sound?
A fair amount of hum, but there's enough audio, we can hear you very well. Go ahead.
Okay, well, as a PL in here, it isn't working right. That's probably where the hum is coming from. My first experience, probably 1955. I was born in 47, so I probably 55 or 54, an RCA with a 5-inch screen, or a 5- or 6-inch screen, and a large mahogany case. I remember watching Howdy Doody, Mickey Mantle, Roger Maris, and the Yankees. That's what I remember, my first exposure to TV, of course, on an antenna. They didn't have cable back then, but that's what I remember. And I don't think we had a color set until well after it was perfected, you know. Anyway, I just wanted to check this guy's radio out. You say there's some hum, but that's probably because of the TL that's halfway wired in there. Back to you, Dick, and we'll be listening a little bit. I'll be to see you again.
Yeah, Eric, it's sounding, Bill, it sounds like either the TL is up too loud or it's being introduced into the audio path too soon. The TL should really be introduced way down at the final FM modulator, well after your speech clipper and things like that.
That's power supply, Dick.
Okay. He thinks it's a TL tone, one or the other. In other words, you think it's 120 hertz power supply, huh? Could very well be. Barry, I wonder if you're on frequency, N2 Mike Bravo. These guys in Brooklyn usually pretty progressive, obvious by the fact that Mel was a couple of years ahead of me on his exposure to television, his exposure to television repair, and Barry being an electronica from way back, I bet you he had a pretty early exposure. Barry, if you're there, N2MB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2JJ.
Okay, yeah. Doug, K2JJ, tell us your first exposure to television and television repair and collecting of parts and whatever. You got it, Doug.
All righty, Dick. Very good evening. Well, never got into much into TV repair. But, I'm a relative youngster, Dick, so my first television watching would have been in the early 1960s, so there you go. Just wanted to let you know the name of that play. It was called The Farnsworth Invention. It closed about a year ago on Broadway.
Was it called The Farnsworth Experiment? The Farnsworth, you think, Invention. The Farnsworth Invention, is what I think you said. Okay. The Farnsworth Invention. That sounds about right. Did I get that right, Doug?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it just closed in March of 08. So it ran for about a year, I guess.
Yeah, and I saw it live. Rather well done by my standards. I was amazed how much technical content was in there. I sort of suspected that a typical play-watching audience wouldn't go for that much technical content. I do remember the screen that came down, the curtain, had a whole lot of electronic symbols and vacuum tube symbols and so on. And by the way, I'm probably in the dark ages here, Rich, N2EO, but somebody has recently brought to my attention the website of the Tube Collectors Association, TCA. And I can't get to the right tube within their website, but there was a page where it shows you a whole lot of very early tubes, magnetrons and klystrons and whatever. I'll bet you you've been interested in that organization for a long time. Let's see if Rich is there to confirm that. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. Well, I have a small tube collection. I haven't been serious about tubes, and I'm not familiar with that, but I do have some Arcturus Blues. I have some Cunningham Triodes from the 20s. I have a VT2, which is spherical. It's shaped like a light bulb. It's World War I vintage triode. I have a few of those. And, I was born in 1950, Dick. So I always remember TV. My parents, I'm told, got a set when I was very young. So I grew up with Howdy Doody and Captain Video and Captain Midnight. And I think Channel 13, I remember we lived in the apartments in Astoria. I believe in the 50s, I could be wrong, but Channel 13 was WNDT, Whiskey November Delta Tango. I remember it was a New Jersey station. That's what I do remember. And, mentioned this story on Weimark a number of times, but what got me into radio, and I don't know why I was so fascinated, but I was hooked. When I was about 6 or maybe 7 years old, my mother bought a crystal radio kit from the old Remco toy company, and I sat down and she put it together, and I watched her put it together, and then a week or two later, I took it apart and breadboarded it on a piece of wood, and from then on, I was building crystal radios. Me and my father were running antennas up to the roof, and that's what got me started in radio. When I was 12 years old, I was on CB. I got my ham lights until I was 15, but back in 62, 63, I was repairing the tube CB radios of the day. And changing modulated tubes and final tubes and boosting them up to like all of 7 watts output. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, TechNet, Weimark, N2EO.
Our early beginnings. The way we cut our teeth in electronics. if you haven't already gone there, Rich, I know you'll appreciate this site. www.tubecollectors.org. Tubecollectors.org. And then go to also tubecollectors.org/tubecall. tubecall.htm. And you'll see pictures of the front covers of various magazines that they've had, the Tube Collectors Association. You'll see some of these older tubes. And when you get to the right page, you can get a nice full-size picture of each of these very exotic tubes. Some of them are the early microwave tubes that we use for radar and whatever. Tubes are going to be around for a long time to come. Okay. I think we have no real questioners tonight. I'm going to double-check that. Unless anyone has some comments, and if not, I'm going to go into a little bit of talk about directional couplers, because it's an extremely handy component, not very expensive, but not very well understood. Even with electrical engineering students, graduate electrical engineering students, have, by my standards, a rather poor understanding of a directional coupler and what it can do. And an awful lot of the work that I have done professionally has been involved with directional couplers, with proper understanding of them and their limitations, and they can do things way beyond what is written on the front panel of a directional coupler. Your directional coupler may say it's operational with 10 dB of coupling from 2 to 4 gigahertz, and you would say, gee, I can't go very far below 2 or very far above 4 before it's going to explode. Well, I have personally taken things like that, 2 to 4 gigahertz, and used it down at 10 megahertz and got beautiful performance out of it, as long as you know how it works and what to expect. So before I get into all that jazz, did we skip anybody so far tonight who had real questions that they've signed in and would like answered? Give me your call letters and name right now, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Dick, I have a quick traffic to mail.
Okay, that's noted. Anyone else while we're collecting names and call letters? Go right ahead with your traffic for Mel.
Okay, Mel, are you there? K2KUY, N2EO, quick one. Okay, I'm restoring a KWM1 that I bought. I wonder if you might have, I would like, I'm having trouble finding a 9.1 megacycle crystal to the 14.2 megacycle slot in the KWM1. If you have one, I would like to have it, and a check would be forthcoming.
They'd have to find. I have a case of crystals. God knows how many. Somewhere buried. Where? That's the point, because I've got a few basements here. I got a property, and every basement's got stuff. I'd have to look around. I know what you're looking for. I don't know if I have one, and I don't know where to look for it. I'll have to think about it, Rich, but if I have it, it's yours. I'd be more than glad to give it to you as a present, but I don't think I'll have much use for it. Yeah, I, as you said, I have so much stuff. You mentioned old tubes and all and things like that. Oh, God, I won't even get into it. I'll take up the whole net, tech net tonight, plus, just to describe half the things I've got. So I'll look around, Rich. I don't know, but there's possibility. Where? I don't know where it even is. I'll have to think on where is that box. It was a big box, a load of crystals, dating back most of them to World War II, over.
Okay, these are, you know, the style of the crystal. I forget what they call the holder, but same holder as they use in the KWM2, you know, the metal crystals, 9.1 megahertz. And this is a KWM1. That I'm working on. So, Dick, thank you very much. Let me turn it back to you. K2RIW, TechNet Limark, M2EO.
The great big crystal holder that had a metal plate on the front with four screws that you could open up, and inside you would find a spring that held down the two contacts to the actual piece of quartz, and two great big pins coming out of the bottom. I think it was called an FT243 holder. Does that sound correct, Mel? Go ahead.
No, didn't use that. That was even earlier. These are the little metal ones. I think they called the HCU new type case. In other words, this is a sealed little one with the pins just sticking out the bottom. You're thinking of the FC-243, sounds like a World War II version, Dick, over.
Yes, it certainly was World War II version. And so my very first rig built in 1956 that operated on 80 meters, a CW rig, 25 watts, the equivalent of a 6W6 tube or something like that in it, and a 5U4 rectifier, or a 5W4. I think it was a 5U4. I probably still have that darn rig. The 25 watt novice rig that I, as I said, I used on 80 meters, 3700 to 3750 I think we were allowed to use. I don't think I ever used it on 40 meters. It used those kind of crystals. And it was basically an oscillator, final, all in one tube. And the oscillator just turned on and off as you grounded the cathode of the tube with your Morse code key. Remember the early days. Okay, let me give you guys a quick rundown on directional couplers. And my first introduction to one. And I guess my first introduction to one was, I'm going to make a guess, 1956 or so. In those days, television sets, the transmission line between the antenna on the roof and the television set was always 300 ohm twin lead. Coax had not become popular when it comes to television aerial wiring in those days. Everything was 300 ohm twin lead. And I don't know if I had invented this myself or somebody gave me a hint, but I was over at my grandmother's house. The 300 ohm twin lead came down the side of the house from the antenna on the chimney, went over to the window in the living room where the television set was, and so there was a horizontal run of the 300 ohm twin lead. My grandmother's window was in between where the 300 ohm twin lead came down the side of the house and the living room. So the twin lead basically passed her window, and she eventually acquired a second television set for her bedroom and wanted it to be operational. And the idea I did was to take a second piece of 300 ohm twin lead, lay it parallel to the main one that went between the antenna and the living room set, laid it parallel to the existing one. So the two pieces of 300 ohm twin lead are laying side by side, taped together, and I guess the length in which they were parallel to each other was something in the vicinity of 8 or 10 inches. So in other words, the strong enough signal being picked up in Kings Park by the television aerial, a sample of it was going to this so-called repeater.
Time out.
A sample of it was going through this coupler, just the twin lead laying parallel, taped together with, I don't know, with scotch tape or black electrical tape, and hung outside the house. That picked up enough of the sample so that the set in the bedroom of my grandmother worked very well, simultaneous to the set in the living room. The only slight problem the system had was that those early sets, like RCA 630 with 6J6 tubes, the tuner had a fair amount of local oscillator re-radiation. So there were certain combinations of channels. I think channel 7 and channel 11 was one of the combinations where if one of the sets was tuned to channel 11 and the other set was tuned to channel 7, you would see herringbones on the screen because the local oscillator of one was mixing with the picture carrier with the other. So except for a little bit of cross-coupling of local oscillators, the system worked very well. So each set could be individually tuned. And that was a very early directional coupler. What set me into thinking about directional couplers is that one of these freebie magazines that gets mailed to me is Wireless Design and Development. Wireless Design and Development. The February 2009 issue on page 10 has an article entitled Specifying Directional Couplers for Critical Applications. The article contains a couple of math errors, but still it's got some nice pictures as to what is a directional coupler. I guess it was Barry or Rich who earlier today was telling me about the fact that the mono match, the first directional coupler many of us amateurs became familiar with was a article in QST magazine in which you would take a piece of coax cable similar to RG8U. Let me drop. You would peel away some of the outer polyethylene jackets that you had bare outer copper braid. You would snake a piece of enameled wire under the braid for a couple of inches and then bring it back out again. And if you properly terminated the ends of that piece of enameled wire, enameled because it had to be insulated from the outer braid shield, but it's under the shield, so therefore it has a certain coupling coefficient between the enameled wire and the true semiconductor of your piece of RG8U coax cable. That can be a beautiful directional coupler when it is properly terminated. At one end, you put a crystal diode rectifier. I think maybe you did on both ends. And depending on which crystal rectifier you used, you were listening to the forward signal or the reverse signal. When you put the right value of resistors terminating the piece of enameled wire, it became a directional coupler. And every directional coupler has two properties, or maybe three properties you care about. One is coupling coefficient. It literally takes a sample of the signal that's flowing down the semiconductor of the coax cable, and it doesn't really interfere with the main signal flowing down the cable. It just takes a sample of it, like 1% of it, if it happens to be a 20 decibel directional coupler. And what determines the amount of coupling is how close is the auxiliary wire to the main semiconductor. That spacing primarily creates the coupling coefficient. You can make the coupling coefficient anything from 1 decibel all the way up to 40 decibels by just varying that spacing or the amount of shielding, so to speak, that there is between the primary semiconductor and your auxiliary semiconductor. In the case of the monomatch, that's that piece of enameled wire that you snaked underneath the braid. When you properly terminate that piece of enameled wire on both ends with the right value of a resistor, and in some cases you have to put a small trimmer capacitor to make things work correctly, when you use the right value, the thing develops a property called a directivity. First of all, the spacing gives you coupling coefficient. You can decide that I'm going to take a 1% sample. In other words, if I'm running a
repeater, time out.
If my main transmitter is putting 100 watts down the semiconductor, and if I had designed the directional coupler for a 20 decibel coupling coefficient, 20 decibels when you work it backwards is a ratio of 100 to 1 in power. So if 100 watts is flowing down the main semiconductor, 1 watt could be flowing down your auxiliary piece of wire in my example. When you put the right terminating resistors on the ends of that wire, you will find that you've made something with high directivity, and it becomes a counter-directional coupler. If my transmitter, assume I've got on the desk in front of me a horizontal piece of coax cable. Transmitter's on the left-hand side of the cable, and my antenna is connected to the right-hand side of the cable. So under normal circumstances, the signal is flowing from left to right of that cable that's laying on my table. When you properly set up the directional coupler, the auxiliary line will pick up a signal that on the auxiliary line flows from right to left, flows in the opposite direction, a little bit opposite from common sense. That's one of the reasons why among the smart people it's called a counter-directional coupler. The coupling works backwards from common sense. And when you use the right terminating resistors, it develops not only a coupling coefficient, but directivity. The signal that flows backwards on the auxiliary cable could be easily 20 dB stronger than the signal that flows in the opposite direction on the auxiliary piece of semiconductor, the piece of enameled wire in my example. And therefore, you're, in the case of looking at the left-hand diode rectifier on that auxiliary piece of wire, I would be taking a sample of what the transmitter is putting out. If there's any standing wave ratio on the antenna and signal is reflecting back down the cable, then the counter-directional characteristic, when you have it properly balanced so it has directivity, will be picked up by the right-hand diode. So the signal flowing from my antenna from right to left as a reflected signal will get picked up by the auxiliary piece of wire and flow from left to right in the opposite direction on the auxiliary piece of wire, end up as a signal on the rectified diode
repeater. Time out.
That signal will pick up by the right-hand rectifying diode. Now with a switch on the front panel of this model match. You would first flip the switch to pick up the left-hand diode, adjust your gain-adjusting potentiometer so that the rectified signal is going into a meter movement, and you adjust for full scale. You then flip over to pick up the signal from the right-hand diode, and any signal that gets picked up there represents the ratio of forward to reverse. In other words, that is a standing wave ratio bridge. The theory of operation is nearly identical to the way the slug works on a bird watt meter. The slug on the bird watt meter, that little probe that you plug in, the slug that you plug in has a probe inside, which again is a piece of wire laying parallel to the main semiconductor inside the bird watt meter. And depending on whether you've got the slug in the forward or reverse mode, you're picking up the forward going signal and measuring how many watts coming out of the transmitter, or the reverse going signal and find out how many watts is being reflected from the antenna. And once you know that ratio and you go to a math table or your handheld calculator, you can calculate the standing wave ratio by those two measurements with your bird watt meter. So directional couplers are very handy. They allow you to take a sample. Let me drop. And if you want to know what is the insertion loss going to be for a properly operating directional coupler, the answer is it obeys conservation of energy. If I've got 100 watts coming out of the transmitter flowing down my piece of coax cable, and my directional coupler is a 20 dB coupling coefficient coupler, that's a fancy way of saying it's sampling 1% of the power. Therefore, my coupled line is going to pick up 1 watt when 100 watts is flowing down the main line. That means the main line has 99 watts left over that goes to the antenna. Conservation of energy must be obeyed here. But these things don't give you the characteristics of a perpetual motion machine. You can't manufacture power here. So once you set the coupling coefficient, you can figure out rather easily what is the semiconductor insertion loss going to be and how much power you're going to get on your directional line. When the coupler is properly balanced, which usually means setting the right load resistors on the auxiliary cable, when that's set correctly, you can have, if you're careful enough in the tuning, extremely high directivity. In other words, it will favor a signal in one direction compared to the other direction by at least a 20 decibels, maybe a 30 decibel, and if you're really careful, a 40 decibel ratio. In other words, when you're looking at the diode that's favoring forward-going signal, which is sampling what's coming out of your transmitter and flowing up the transmission line, you would like it at that time to not simultaneously be responding to the signal on the main transmission line that flows in the opposite direction. That characteristic of favoring one direction of signal compared to the other is called directivity, and it's a rating in decibels. You look at the manufacturer's spec sheets for directional couplers, and you will see a coupling coefficient, standing wave ratio, and directivity. A good commercial quality, let me drop. A good commercial quality directional coupler has a directivity of at least 15 or 20 decibels. A high quality one will be 30 decibels of directivity. Instrumentation grade can be 40 decibels. I own a waveguide type directional coupler that's made with WR90 waveguide, X-band waveguide. That's a waveguide that's 9/10 of an inch wide on the internal widest dimension. And this particular very well manufactured directional coupler made by Singer, I can't remember the other, Singer Anderson, there's two companies linked together in this darn thing. And if I look right here, I think I've got the thing right on the desk in front of me so I can read the brand name off of it. Nope. Wrong. Now I'm not quite sure where I put the darn thing. Anyhow. Andrew? Nope, not Andrew, but it's a company that begins with the name A. This particular thing I bought at a flea market in Nashua, New Hampshire, quite a few years ago. It has a real interesting look to it. That's the reason why I bought it, because it looks so nice and it only cost me $2. The darn thing has more than 50 decibels of directivity. In other words, you put a well to tuned X-band feed horn on one end of this directional coupler and a transmitter on the other end, and because it favors directivity so high, if you set